Glad to see everybody's very relaxed. I hope I can stay that way through this talk. My name is Bob Pasch, P-A-A-S-C-H. I was the geologist here during the last 4 years of operation of the mine. When I was asked to give a talk on this, they really asked me to talk about some of the life of living here at Holden. And I have no prepared plan of talk. I'm just going to sit and reminisce for a while. Some of the stories that I can recall, one of the ones had to do with getting the power supply into the mine. At one time, they planned on a hydroelectric power supply, but even back in 1937, when they were trying to do that, that was very difficult to get the permitting for. So they finally got Washington Water Power to run a power line into the mine. Well, this power line comes up the far side of Lake Chelan, and it crosses Lake Chelan right near Domke Lake, Domke Mountain. One of the requirements for putting in that power line was that they had to paint all of the poles green. Not too many people could have come up the lake then and found that power line, really. It was very hard to find. Another requirement was that most of the purists would never want to walk up this road that was built. So in addition to building that road, the company had to build a trail on the other side of the creek. So whether many of you realize it or not, there was a trail that was built all the way up that side of the creek. I don't think 10 people used it after it was built. Nonetheless, that was one of the requirements for building the mine here. Life here was kind of a close-knit community. Of course, most of you had heard about what we did here, such as our bowling alleys. That was a big thing in the wintertime. We had very competitive bowling leagues. Summertime, we had very competitive softball leagues. Most of you know that field up at the end of the far end of the camp. Well, that was our softball field. And so we had some awfully good softball games up there. Talk a little bit about the mine. I'll give you a little bit of terminology of my trivia pursuit, if you will. The main portal level, the haulage level, was called a 1,500-foot level. Well, what's the 1,500-foot level? Well, that's 1,500 feet down from the uppermost outcrop of the ore zone where it crosses Copper Mountain. So that's the zero level up there. There was, between the 1,500-zero level and the 1,500-foot level, about five other levels. You look up on the side of the mountain, you'll see waste dumps. When they went in from the side of the mountain with their adits, and the waste was brought out and just dumped down over the mountain. So those remnants of each of those levels are still up there on the side of the mountain. And of course, at the 1,500-foot level is the major waste dumps for all of the workings below the 1,500-foot level, because there are no other adits going into the ore zone below the 1,500-foot level. So everything below 1,500-foot was hoisted up. We went down. The lowest level was called a 2,500-foot level. So that's from the outcrop, that's essentially half a mile down into that mountain that we were doing our work. Stoping methods that we used in there were very, very large tonnage. As you probably have read, we mined over 10 million tons of ore during the life of this mine. That was beginning in 1938 up through 1957. The amounts of minerals that we took out there was something like 200 million pounds of copper, about 40 million pounds of zinc, 2 million ounces of silver, and about 500,000 ounces of gold. What kind of minerals were there? There was none of these nice little beautiful specimens that you find in museums. In fact, if you walk up the roads along here, you look down, you see a piece of oxidized rock that looks like this. Well, this has probably come out of the mine because they use the waste materials for fill in various places around here. So if you're looking for ore samples, you don't really have to go up to the mine or up to the waste dump there. Just up here by the footbridge, you'll look down, you'll see some of this oxidized rock. Take a piece of it, break it, open it up, and there's a piece of the types of ore that we did, that we mined in this mine. I picked up these this morning just walking up there. The principal minerals, chalcopyrite was the copper mineral, sphalerite was the zinc mineral. The gold was physically mixed with the chalcopyrite. We could never find it in any of our slides that we produced. So don't go looking for gold. You'll never find it around here. The silver was principally mixed with the sphalerite, the zinc mineral. And again, it was physically mixed. Primarily tetrahedrite was the silver mineral that was occurred in the ore. The ore zone was zoned. On the footwall, we had the high sphalerite, the zinc mineral. On the going out toward the hanging wall, we had the high chalcopyrite. We sometimes did not even float off the zinc and just recovered the chalcopyrite only. Safety record of the mine, I've been asked this several questions. Any mining operation back 25 years ago was fraught with quite a bit of danger. During my 4 years here, we did lose four lives. And I think in the years previous, it was not much different than that. Since that time, mining regulations have been much more stringent, but still mining is not one of the safest industries in this country right now. Timbering, I think, ranks first, and then mining second as being the most dangerous. The mill tailings out here, at one time we were pumping these back into the mine to fill stopes to stabilize the ground. One of the problems we had in doing the mining was that as we would open up these big stopes, we would get a lot of caving coming off what they call a hanging wall. The shear zone in which the mineral deposit occurs dips at about 70 degrees. Of course, this would be the foot wall over here, and this would be the hanging wall over here. So we'd mine across this, but the problem would be that we'd start getting caving out of the hanging wall, and this is country rock, if you want to call it that, which does not produce very much mineral. So the mine itself is beginning to get a lot of what they call rock falls and unstable ground. So we thought we could use the tailings to help stabilize the stopes that we'd mined out. So to do this, we had to go in and build bulkheads in all of the openings going into these tremendous stopes. So we would put in about 6 foot concrete, 6 foot thick concrete dams, if you will, in these. And then these we would have a drainage pipe to drain the water out. So once we got all of these openings, these raises, cross cuts, and so forth, going into the stopes filled, we would take the mill tailings and sluice them back into the mine. We used large wooden pipes to do this, and we'd have about a 50% solid, 50% water sluicing to take the mill tailings back into the mine. This was all done actually before I came here. Actually, right before I came here, one of these dams that they built to keep the tailings in one of these stopes broke. Out starts this whole tremendous 200-foot high head of milled tailings down into the mine. This thing was only an opening about this big around, about a foot in diameter, but still it fed these tailings down into the drifts. It started flowing down to all the raises, down to the lower levels. From there it spread out to where it completely, not completely, but filled almost every drift in the lower workings of the mine up about 2 or 3 feet. They could not stop it. I mean, they had seen it as it had first started spilling out of the stope, but there was no way they could stop it, its flow once it started. Well, that initiated one of the most tremendous and difficult cleanup operations that you can imagine. Normally, when the mining operation, they have what they call overshot mucking machines, where they'll go in with a kind of a little front-end loader that picks up all the materials and then they'll throw it over the machine and into a car behind, into a mine car. Well, they found out that this did not work at all on this mill tailings. It just set up like concrete, very difficult. So what it required was men with number two muck sticks, that's a shovel, not a trivia. Picking this up by hand until it cleared all the haulage ways to where they could start the operation again. This was several months operation just to get the mine going again. But even after I came here, there was many of the drifts that I had to go through that I would go climb up over 3 foot of tailings, and between me and the back is the roof of the drifts, another trivia point, to try to get through these old abandoned drifts. If they didn't need to, they didn't go back into them. The miners. Miners are a strange breed. I don't know how many miners that I said goodbye to here, and they said they would never be back to this godforsaken hole that I saw the next year. In reality, the workforce here was really quite stable, except for what they call a gypo miner. A gypo miner is a contract miner that goes in and does most of the dangerous mining. In other words, the driving of the raises and the drifts, that's where you're constantly drilling, loading, blasting, mucking out, day in, day out. Well, these gypo miners made very good money for what they did. I think at the time that I was working here, I was making about $5,000 a year, which 25 years ago wasn't bad. But a gypo miner would come in and in about 6 months' time would make $10,000. And that was a tremendous salary at the time. Gypo miners, what we called in drilling out a raise, we drilled strictly bald-headed raises here. Bald-headed raise is one that does not have timber in it. So it's just a hole going up about 6 foot diameter or square into the rock, generally on a 70 degree incline is the way that we drilled our raises to develop the ore body. That's mainly because the ore body was on a 70 degree incline, so the raises followed right up the ore body. A bald-headed raise, the miner would, as he drilled out around and blasted it, and then he would drill a hole in the floor of the raise, the bottom part of it, footwall, and put a pin in that, and then he would hang a iron-rung ladder on it. And just keep working his way up into where you've got all these iron-rung ladders. Those of us in the geology crews and survey crews had to climb those bald-headed raises just about as much as the miners did. And one thing that you learn in climbing raises, one guy doesn't go up and get halfway and another guy start. Because once one guy starts up, the minute his foot leaves a rung, the next guy is right behind him. Because when he dislodges a rock up there, he doesn't want it to fall very far before he hits it. So that's something that's true of in mining operations, entirely different than other operations. In climbing raises, ladders, you climb right next to each other. Monday morning was, we had to go and measure for the Gypo miners to see how far they had drilled for the last week. So we would get into some of those raises, but even before the miners had had a chance to go in and knock down all the loose rocks. So I can recall many times hugging that ladder as I could hear one break loose up above and start bouncing against the ribs of the raise coming down. You make yourself awfully small when that happens.
Did they wear hard hats?
Hard hats with a light on them. We had electric cap lamps, as they're called. We had gotten away from the carbide lanterns of the earlier miners by this time. But yes, we all had hard hats and cap lamps on them. Those cap lamps did go out occasionally, though. And if you're back in some far reach of the mine by yourself, which you would be on occasion, it gets awfully dark back there. Because there's no other lights. We didn't have any electric lights strung through the mine, except on the main haulage ways. Well, I haven't talked all that long yet, have I?
What about food?
What about what?
About food.
What about food? The commissary, is this it? Or, no, we had a store.
Oh, we had a company. Lot 6.
No, it was on this side. Yeah, it's Lot 6. Be the next one. Lot 6 was the store, yet most people would get their food from Chelan. So once a week, you would make up a shopping list and a nice long list, 3 boxes of post toasties and 10 pounds of sugar and what have you. And then you would give this to the, you'd send it down to the store. You'd mail it down to the store, and then once a week, the store would box up all these boxes of food and send it up on the barge that brought the company's supplies up. So one day a week was company store when everyone got their food up from Chelan. We did have a small store here. We operated on what they called tin. Tin was a little piece of aluminum, a little disc. Might even be some of those around that I haven't seen any up in the museum, but that was worth a dollar. Well, most miners could not make it from one payday to the other. Mm-hmm. So they would go down to the store and they could draw $5 worth of tin at a time to go do their gambling down at the rec hall over here. What have you. So we lived on the tin system from paycheck to paycheck. There was, over in the rec hall, a pretty constant poker game going on, and there's always seemed to be a fantan game, and I watched that game for hours, and from this day I have yet to know how to play the game. I never could understand it. But
there was no alcohol up here, was there?
Or anything like that? In the homes, yes. I mean, there was no restriction on it. It probably was one of the major homebrew producing areas in the country.
You always think of a mine, you know, you think of pictures on the shores of Raleigh, Brooklyn, and Manhattan, and some Braden Cain type.
No, it wasn't really. The action place was the rec hall, and that was pretty mild, and really there wasn't. Going back a few years, though, I guess when they first started the mine, alcohol was not available here, and as someone mentioned in the orientation yesterday, most of the miners at the end of the day's work went down the hill. In fact, they lived down at Lucerne, and there was some pretty good taverns down there at that time. That is, of course, before my time, so I never really got involved in that.
Did the families live up here, and how did the kids get to school?
We had a schoolhouse right here that was from 1 through the 6th grade, the last building down on this side. Mrs. Hal Fields was the teacher of that, and as you're aware, the Fields Point is going to be taken over by the group and operated the kit concessionaire there, and this was owned by Hal and Mrs. Fields for many, many years. And they, Hal Fields worked here, and Mrs. Fields was the school principal. After sixth grade, all the kids went out to high school and to college. I can recall in Christmas time when the high school kids and the college kids, boys principally, came back, we and the engineering staffs and minors always had a challenge basketball game over here in the gymnasium. And the whole balcony would be lined with people rooting for one group or the other. Those were real good games. Yes, we had lots of families living here. As I recall, there were 103 houses up in the what they call family camp. In fact, I owned one of those when I first came here, and I owned it when they burned it down some years later. much to my chagrin. My last 2 years, I lived on number 10 chalet up here at the head of the circle. Oh, I was telling a story the other day about television. Back in the 50s, television was still in its infancy, but lo and behold, if we did not get television signals coming into this little remote valley up here, and they came from Spokane, channels 2, 4, and 6, and they came up over a range of mountains 7,500 feet high and then down, so the time the signal was bounced down in here wasn't the best signal in the world. So, nonetheless, I mean, something like that was a very critical thing to us. So we developed a television cable system. In fact, I put it in. In fact, there's still some remnants of it up here. I lived in that uppermost house. I went into a fir tree behind there, put a great big stacked Yagi antenna system in there, came in through my upstairs window, and I had amplifiers there that I fed a cable system to every one of those 13 houses and into all of those dormitories. So we did have a very good cable system here. Well, all the people in the upper camp, we used to put up great big stacked Yagis that they called them at the time, and the signal would get awfully snowy. I mean, it was. But we went up onto the side of the mountain with a what we called a field strength meter and an antenna, and we were able to pick up probably the best signal in this whole valley. Was sitting up there on one of those mine waste dumps. So we went back into the mine and we strung a power cable all the way up from the 1,500 foot level up to about the, I think it's about 500 foot level. And some of those old ladders in there were rotten. I mean, oh, were they rotten. You'd walk on the sides of them, never in the center, because main portion of the mine, of the mineralized area, has been mined out. The this ore body is kind of a funny one. This shear zone that the ore body occurs in can be traced for 25 or 30 miles. You can go down near 25 Mile Creek and fly right over this thing, right up through this area, right on up through past Mount Bonanza. But the only ore chute in it occurs right here on Copper Peak. we did, in fact, drive a tunnel about a mile under Buckskin Mountain, and right on the 1,500 foot level. And we drilled out into the mineralized zone, and we've got beautiful pyrite all the way through there. Pyrite, what is it? Iron sulfide, no copper. Chalcopyrite is copper iron sulfide. We did the same thing out in the middle of Railroad Creek, on up past the ball field. We brought in a diamond drill rig, drilled down through the mineralized zone. We had about 200 feet of the most beautiful pyrite you ever saw. other mining operations in this area. Really, there are none. During World War I, the Germans were in someplace in that era, were up by Hart Lake. And right across on the other side of the falls there at Hart Lake, there are some adits going in there that were for molybdenum mines. So they were looking for molybdenum. I have a hard time with that word, back then. Up, if you go to Holden Lake, up on the side of Martin Ridge, a few hundred feet, there's an adit going back in. It's called a Mary Green adit. Just goes back in about 100 feet. I've looked at everything in there and couldn't find anything. Over a 9 mile, up on the trail, as you walk that trail, there's a little adit going back in there. But really, there are no other mining operations anywhere here. On up Stehekin, up in the Horseshoe Basin, they have got quite a bit of lead, silver mineralization up there. And they built, the road up there was built as a mine-to-mill road back 30s, I think that was. So their Horseshoe Basin did have a small amount of mining in it. They never will now. It's part of the national park system.
When you and I were talking this morning, you were talking about surveying the mountain up here and your test hole and went off to get mining claim. What was the advantage of that late in the program?
A lot of our exploration work under Buckskin was done under government-sponsored exploration programs that back in the 50s was during the Korean War era, and they did have a mineral exploration program. We wanted to explore further under that direction. Well, the exploration season on the surface is only a few months long. Underground, it goes all year long. But to do this exploration on the extension of the shear zone, we had to have surface claims staked on all the area that we were going to be doing the exploration in. And I had the task of going up into Copper Basin and doing all of the claim staking. To stake a claim, you've got two things that you've got to do. One, you've got to put in quarter posts on the four corners of the claim, and the other is to dig a discovery pit. Well, a discovery pit is supposed to be on the showing of the mineralization, and it has to be a certain size. I don't recall what it was. So for one summer, I had the task of going up there, doing all this claim staking. We would leave here in the morning by at 8 o'clock, go all the way up in the Copper Basin, spend the day working, and that evening come back down again. And by the end of that summer, I was in pretty good shape. So I was telling a story earlier. We spent almost a week looking for a patent survey corner. When they patent a claim, a government patent surveyor comes in and does an official survey of that claim, and then you go through the patent process to make that claim no longer just a requiring yearly assessment work. It is now owned by the person who got the patent. But to do this, they have to put in do the patent survey, and they put in very permanent markings for reference survey points. Well, there was one shown on the map, on the survey earlier patent claim map. So I spent 1 week looking for that survey corner. About 5 years later, I ran across a fellow that had put in that survey, and I said, you know, I never could find that. And he kind of stared at the ceiling for a moment and says, you know, we never did put that one in. And if you've ever been up in that country, you would understand why. Because we did our claim staking with ropes and pitons and ice axes and everything else. That is just sheer cliffs up there. That is very, very difficult to work in. The other thing I remember about that was the we would get up there early, mosquitoes were still on the trees, and there would just be a solid mass of mosquitoes on all the things. But by about 10 o'clock when the sun came out, they came out, and 612 seemed to be the mosquito repellent best in use at the time, and you took about four bottles and you put it on thick enough to drown them.
established reference point if there, if you couldn't find one, if there wasn't, hadn't been one in there?
We carried a line up. We used Brunt and Compass surveys, carried it right up the trail. In fact, there were some established earlier reference points down in the basin itself. The one point I was talking about was over on the other side, actually over in the Eniat drainage, because we carried our claims on over onto the far side. And once you find a, have a reference point, you just use what they call a Brunton survey compass, which all geologists carry in the little leather pouch on the side of their, on their belt. But you can get awfully good with those things. And, excuse me.
What is the tunnel down at Lucerne above the hydro plant there that goes into the side of the hills?
Oh yes, that was another one that was drilled. Oscar Getty was one of the early pioneers in this area, Packers. And Oscar used to tell me about that. I honestly don't remember what they were looking for at the time, but it was just an exploration adit that was put back in there.
Do you know how far back that goes?
No, I don't.
Is that all?
Are all those adits that are around here, were they done by large companies like Howe Sound, or were they just old guys like Oscar Getty wandering around?
Some of those early ones were just exploration guys going in exploring, and they would come on the surface and they would start taking a point and a single jack and start drilling holes, and they get about 6 or 8 holes drilled, and they'd load them with powder and blast it out, and they'd keep enlarging it and work their way back, and all done by hand.
I wonder about the fire hazard in the village. When we were talking to the fire chief, she said that when this was a mining camp, there weren't as many fires as this. When it was turned over to the Lutherans, were they careful about smoking in certain places?
I don't know whether you want to attribute it to luck or not, but no, we didn't have any really major fires until after they announced the closing of the mine. There were at least 2 houses, I recall, burned down very shortly after that. Then I think it was very shortly after that, all the insurance companies canceled all insurance up here, too.
So then they didn't really have a plan in case of fire?
We had, yes, we had a very structured volunteer fire department and drills very frequently. We had a firehouse right up here, I can remember it, on the side. We had special fire trucks. So we were certainly aware of the danger and guarded it against as best we could.
Is Howe Sound mine still in operation someplace? Or are they mining somewhere?
Howe Sound Company was a Canadian company. Their first large mine was a Britannia mine up in on Howe Sound, north of Vancouver. The Howe Sound Company also owned a gold mine up in Snow Lake, Manitoba, silver mines down in Mexico, a cobalt mine at Cobalt, Idaho, a cobalt smelter down at Garfield, Utah. Today, the Howe Sound Company is the Howe Met Company on the New York Stock Exchange. To my knowledge, they do not have any mining operations left whatsoever. Last I remember, they were making hosiery manufacturing machinery.
Were all the other mines that Howe Sound owned, were they all as efficient as this one and built up? Did they have communities built like this? Or was this kind of their model mine?
They brought the technology of the Britannia mine down to this one, the type of stoping. In fact, the ore bodies are remarkably similar, both about 70-degree dipping, about 100-foot wide, mineralized zones. So the mining methods they used there were brought down here, and those at the time were very efficient mining operations. I can't really tell you about the other ones because I had never been, have never been to the ones in Mexico or to Snow Lake, Manitoba, or the cobalt mine in Idaho.
Well, above the tailings, there's some remains that look like trestles. Is that part of that thing you were talking about, where they were trying to get the tailings back up into the mine?
Those probably were strictly to take the tailings out to the tailings ponds.
Yeah. The big, great big concrete abutments.
There was a kind of a distribution box system up here, and I think if you've been up there on that level, you'll see what looks like several openings coming out of a plenum there, and that fed to the various mill tailings ponds. And they used wooden lines, wood because it does not wear out as fast as steel. So most of them were wooden lines that they transported the tailings through, and they were, as I remember, about foot diameter, something like that.
Could you describe taking the ore down the mountain to the lake?
Okay, our milling operation, the mill feed percent of copper in the ore was about 1%. By the time that they had milled it and floated off the minerals, it got it up around 20%. So what they have now is a very finely ground steel and ore, but only about 20% copper containing. This, after it was dried, was put into buckets which were about 6 feet in diameter and about 10 feet tall. These buckets were loaded, as I remember, 3 to a semi-trailer and trucked down to the lake. Here they had a great large hoist. They would pick them up, set them on the barge, and load it up until they got the barge loaded. Now the barge plied its way down Lake Chelan to what they call the Chelan Station. No, I beg your pardon. They call it Lake Chelan. There they were offloaded at Howe Sound Company's docks there and back onto trucks, where they were hauled down to Chelan Station, which is down at the Columbia River, right below the town of Chelan, which is about 1,000 feet lower, about 600 feet lower. Here they were loaded onto trains. They were taken then over to Tacoma, to the Tacoma smelter of Asarco, I believe, owns it. And there they did the final refining of the ore. Yes?
Can you trace through what they do to the ore before they put it in the buckets and where the tailings actually come from?
Could you repeat that?
Can you trace through, okay, when they mine the ore out, it's in big rocks and what have you. Just trace through what they do to it before they put it in the buckets and where the tailings come from in that process.
Okay. As we mined in these very, very large stopes, we would blast, literally thousands of tons of rock down at a time. This ore was drawn out through what we call draw holes into a drift, to where a man sat there at one end of the drift with a hoist, which has got long cables going to the other end with a bucket attached. They would pull this ore down to the what they called a grizzly. It would feed down through a grizzly into an ore chute. The ore chute was kind of a surge bin to store the rock as they pull it out the bottom into the ore trains. Most of this rock was anything from just a few inches up to maybe a foot or so in diameter. Anything larger than a foot was broken up by secondary blasting right in the slusher drifts before it was put into the ore cart. So now we've got rock that's about a foot in diameter. This was run through what they call jaw crushers. This broke it down to about a quarter inch size, where it's fairly uniform, either quarter inch or below. This rock then was put into ball mills. These are giant circular rotating drums containing essentially small cannonballs made out of steel. And these are what they call ball crushers or ball mills. And this got it down to its final size, to where it was then run through the mill, through the flotation circuits of the mill. What is a flotation circuit? Trivia pursuit again. flotation circuit is one in which they feed in some chemicals which are not unlike detergents into a water mixture of this mill, of this crushed up ore. And certain of these chemicals have an affinity for various minerals. but not necessarily rocks that don't have some metal content to them. So the rocks that have a metal content, the minerals, chalcopyrite, the sphalerite, pyrrhotite, and so forth, would cling to bubbles that was formed by air being aerated through this water ore mixture. And as it clinged through, as these bubbles rose to the surface, they would keep feeding enough into it to where this would froth over into a channel and be channeled off. So that would be the mineral that they wanted to retain, whereas all of the solids then would be accumulated in the bottom of the tanks and would be drawn off the bottom of these tanks, which are about 10 or 12 feet deep. And those then were the tailings that went out to the tailings pond, the waste rock. They do contain some minerals. You never get 100% recovery from them. Does that answer your question?
About what was the percentage of recovery?
It approached about 90%.
90%.
I think it was
That's
about
pretty high. Isn't it?
It's not too bad, yeah. But
that's those big, there's seven ponds with those great big gigantic tanks up there that are just above the shop level there. They've got some great big tanks. Is that what they were used to use for the chemicals?
They were settling ponds, as you said. They also had what they call filter screens, where the water would be taken out of the mill feet of the mill output and actually dry it as best they could.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm.
Can you comment on the winter lake?
Show a lot of snow.
Yes, it's well, I'll tell you. When winter came, all the cars that people had up here went down to the lake, and that's where they were stored. There were actually two cars that were allowed to stay up here at the mine. That's because the roads get very narrow, and there's 10-foot high banks on both sides. But the two cars that were allowed to stay here were the mine managers and mine. Well, as a result of my having put in a cable TV system, I was also the TV repairman for the campsite. And that was one of the critical reasons for having a car here. Actually, we had an ambulance, too, that stayed here. It was in a garage. It was parked right up here alongside of the road, but I don't think that building is there any longer. You've seen the average snowfall numbers for the camp. That was about 350 inches. And up until about 1951, the record had been 461 inches. Lo and behold, in 1956-57 winter, we got 625 inches of snow. That is 50 feet of snow. Well, needless to say, snow was piled pretty high and deep at that time. Of course, a lot of people tunneled under it rather than going to over the top. Really, that's a lot harder. And don't ever really try it for efficiency, but a lot of people did it for novelty. And but it seemed like for about 3 weeks there, we saw nothing but snow day and night, and I mean as much as a foot an hour, just constantly. And so insulation of the houses was beautiful in the wintertime. I'm sure most people know that now, that we would, most people burned wood, or a lot of them did, I did, and as I recall, I could throw a couple of pine logs in there in the morning and keep the house nice and warm all day, a couple more when I got home, and a couple when I went to bed. It was just all we ever did. Yeah.
What made you decide to come up here?
Well, I was a geologist, and there was a job.
Was that really the only reason? I mean, did you want to work? I mean, because there were other kind of geology jobs you could have done, weren't there?
Probably were, but I heard about the mine. I came up, and I had about a 2-month-old child at the time, so it was quite a thing bringing a baby up here. I mean,
yeah.
My wife was very concerned about hospital care, and how do you take care of a new baby up here? And the doctor assured her people have babies up here all the time. So, and really, we did have a very good doctor in the hospital over here. So.
There was a doctor right here in the
yes.
village?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There was also an operating room up there, too.
Yes, they had an operating room there. And,
wow. What's happened to most of the miners that left here?
Most of the miners that left here?
Yeah.
You know, I ran into an awful lot of them down in the Colorado Plateau country, because when I left here, I went down to the uranium mining area. And you'd be surprised the number of miners I knew here that were working down there then.
According to the paper in the dining hall, it says that a lot of the people lived around in the Chelan and Wenatchee area. Did that have anything to do with the economy then after the mine closed? I mean, is that hurt the economy of this area?
Certainly there was quite a payroll here. About 150 men worked here, and women. And that amounted to a pretty good payroll for the area that was pretty well spent right locally. So they did lose quite a bit of payroll when the mines shut down. A lot of the people, the miners, just went to other mines as they could go to them, down to Bishop, California, over to the Butte, Montana area. All those were still operating at the time, the Coeur d'Alene country. So. Miners always, a good miner always finds a job.
Yeah. We've had miners' reunions up here a couple of times in recent years.
I'm sorry, was that a question or was that just a statement?
No, I just commented that we have had miners' reunions up here in recent years, at least twice that I can think of doing a show up. I think we had over 200, I think around 250 came one year for their families. They chartered the boat, didn't they? Came in and out the same day.
Called it Miner's Day, I believe, didn't they?
We served the big picnic for them.
Mm-hmm. We were unfortunately committed somewhere else, or else we would have been here, certainly.
Mm-hmm. How many were the single miners? You say there were about 100 families out there, and some families here. Were there any families living in the lodges, or were those all single miners?
All single miners lived in the lodges.
So there were three to dinner.
No, I believe there were. Come to think of it, there were couples living there. Mm-hmm. And
about how many single miners would you guess in that proportion yet?
They were much fewer than the married miners. Probably no more than 20% were single.
And did any women work up in the mines?
In the offices.
Not doing the...
No. There was, and there is today, a very strong sentiment among miners not to have women underground, but that's changing.
Comment on you mentioned about the, after the miners going to close, about a couple of fires I had?
Yes.
Well, I have a problem in Alaska that way, and they call it an arson expert. And they found out that what happens sometimes is people will have the mortgage papers and the fire insurance in the same drawer, in a dresser drawer, and sometimes spontaneous combustion results.
No. Everything went on right through the winter. No, the water never froze all the time I was here. And we got our water off out of Copper Creek. And we had a very...
Even when they were doing the tailing, they got the pumping, the tailings and all that, nothing froze up.
I don't recall that it ever did. Certainly there were probably times that we were might have had some short freezes.
What were the labor relations like between the mining and the miners and the administration? Was there any problem with that or anything?
There was one short strike during the time that I was here in about 1955 or 56, probably 56. And generally there was good relations among the miners and management. We did everything we could to maintain such good relations, and Nonetheless, the mining unions were very militant, and someone back in Pittsburgh or someplace said, let's strike, and it would carry right on down to the mines.
Well, I'm sure that we could go on forever, but I think we really need to give Bob a little bit of a break. And if you want to bounce some of your personal questions, individual questions off of him one-on-one, I'm sure he'd be delighted to chat with you. But for now, I think we owe him a big round of applause.